Hello and welcome to episode 12 of The Coriolis Effect, Stockholm Calling. I'm Matthew.
And I'm Dave. And here we are in the Bishop's Arms pub in Gamlestan, in the old town of Stockholm, where we spent the last 36 hours interviewing and spending time with guys from the Frihetligan and from Jern Ringen.
I ought to say, we didn't spend all 24 hours in the pub. We have interviewed them in various locations, but it was this time last night that we were here with Frihetligan, and they were buying us dinner.
They were the most generous bunch of lovely guys I've met in a very long time. So I want to just say a really big thank you to Nils Carlin, Costa Constulas, and Ricard Antroyer, who joined us yesterday. And, of course, to Matthias Lilja and Martin Grip from Jern Ringen, who took us out for lunch today and then had another hour and a bit with us talking lots of really interesting stuff. One more shout out of thanks to Matthias Johnson from Jern Ringen, who couldn't make it with us today, but who was instrumental in making sure that our meeting with Jern Ringen actually happened. So many thanks to all of you. It's been a great couple of days and we've learned lots and lots of stuff.
We've got so much stuff. So we've got hours of recorded material that we need to edit, but we've already got a pretty good idea what's going to be in the first episode, haven't we, Dave?
We have, because one of the great things that's come out of meeting both groups today and yesterday has been hearing the whole story of Coriolis right back from its inception in early days as a Jern Ringen game up through to the point where Frihetligan were fanboys, were freelancers, to the point where they then took the game on themselves, and moving on now to the current day and looking forward to the future. So today's episode is going to be looking very much at the interview bits that we've had talking about the story of Coriolis.
We should have called it Genesis of Coriolis.
We should. So why didn't we?
We called it Stockholm Calling instead.
I know, that was your idea, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
It's not a very good idea. It's nowhere near as good as Genesis of Coriolis.
No, it isn't. It's better than Genesis of Coriolis.
Anyway, let's not argue. We have spent 3 days together, and I was quite tired.
And that's why we're arguing.
I had to share a room last night, and Matthew snores like a monster. But apart from that,
we'll cut that bit out in the edit.
Possibly not. But, so, we will have lots of other stuff to talk about that came out of the discussions we had with both Frihetligan and Jern Ringen, which we will be posting out in additional podcast episodes over the next 2 or 3 weeks, once we've had a chance to look through it and
listen to it properly
and edit it down into a good format.
Yeah. So before we go on, I should say, so I think for the next few episodes, the format's going to be a little bit different from what you've expected from us. I think we'll be concentrating mostly on the interview recordings, topping and tailing them a bit, as we are today. But before we do that, let's do something we always traditionally do at the top of every show, and that is talk about news from the wider world of gaming. Although it's not a particularly wider world this time, is it, Dave?
No, it's not, because the one thing I really wanted to mention and talk about was Simbaroom and the ongoing Simbaroom Kickstarter for the Monster Codex, which, as of recording, has 5 days left. If we get this podcast out over the weekend, as we hope to, there'll be 3 days left. So I'd really want to encourage everybody who hasn't had a look at that to go and have a look, and let's get a last final push to make sure that all the stretch goals and the bids, the pledges that the guys need, we get through all of those and get everything that they want.
Now, of course, I'm a player and not a GM, so I'm letting you invest in this. What are the stretch goals that you're particularly keen on hitting in the final days of the campaign, David?
Well, the Codex itself is not only a monster manual, for want of a better way, but it's much, much more than that. It's looking into a range of things that, as Matthias Lilja was telling us today, and you'll hear at some point in the podcast, is really fleshing out the backstory and the sort of the credentials of the creatures that are in Simbaroom, right? Not just to add more hit points to something and make it more dangerous, as Matthias himself said, but also they're looking at a few other things as well, such as balance resistance tables, which I'm not entirely sure what that exactly means, but that's going to be really interesting to see what that looks like. Also, potentially another playable race Yeah. Which I know Matthew's very excited about.
I'm not so excited about. But lots of our listeners may be excited about this playable race, particularly if you were playing in the early days of RuneQuest. Or indeed, if you were playing in Sweden at all, because I think the Swedes took this particular race to their hearts when RuneQuest in the US was translated into Swedish and became the first Swedish role-playing game. Drakar och Demoner.
Yeah.
That, forgive my incredibly bad Swedish pronunciation there. And that race was one that was came over with other bits of RuneQuest. And in the new Monster Codex, I see they're called the Andrisk,
I think it is. Yeah.
And there's no S there.
Andrik. I thought it was Andrisk. Okay. Anyway, my mistake.
I'm guessing Andrik is a kind of Swedish compound word of man and. And Drick or Drake Duck. Yep, these are bipedal, wingless, but, well... Or,
are they wingless?
Well, they've got wings, but they use them like hands, like Donald Duck does, I think. So.
Okay, well, I think we don't want to call them Donald Duck, do we?
Right.
I know very little about these. I don't have a memory of them from back in old RuneQuest days. But the one picture I've seen, drawn by Martin, is of a duck... In a cloak, looking really menacing, and you know the skill to go into that to make it look really menacing is fabulous. It's a great picture, as with just about every Simbarim picture I've ever seen. They're all really good, and it's really the kind of guy that you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley, you know, late at night in Thistlehold or Granitehold, my location in my campaign for Simbarim.
We learned from Martin and from Matthias, in fact, that this. A painting had been done as an April Fool's joke initially.
Yes.
But due to the support and demand, I think, particularly from Swedish gamers, it's now a stretch goal. And I think it's the next stretch goal to be knocked down, isn't it?
It is. And I think they're pretty close to it. They're only tens of thousands of krona away, which it's £1 to 10 krona very roughly. So, yeah, they're pretty close. So come on, everyone, have a look at it and see what... You know, see if you want to back it in. If you're tempted, go ahead and back it. That would be really good.
And if they hit a million Swedish krona, what's the final stretch goal?
Well, they get the Simbarim roll-up dice tray, which you're much more familiar with than I am, Matthew. You seem really excited by this. I mean, I've never used one, but I think, you know, for my nice kitchen table back at home, rolling lots of dice on it does seem to take the varnish off.
Yeah.
So maybe that'll be a good thing. Tell us
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, so All Rolled Up is a British company who are absolutely lovely people. David, you'll be aware of the dice bag that I bring to our games. It's sort of a bit like a chef's knife kit or one of the roll-up bags you sometimes see carpenters carrying their tools in. But... it's got a compartment for dice, a compartment for a pack of cards, and pockets for pencils and things like that. Mine is a very...
It's an advanced pencil case, is that what you're saying?
No, it's an advanced dice bag. It's an all-rolled-up dice bag. But they've also branched out into dice trays. And funnily enough, when we go to Dragon Meet, hashtag podcast zone... Hashtag
yep.
Dragon Meet 2017,
yep.
I should say.
It's a month away for us.
A month away. When we're going to Dragon Meet, I'd already resolved that I was going to buy from All Rolled Up. They're normally there at the stall. I was going to buy a couple of dice trays, which are a lovely design. It's a very simple design that it itself can be rolled up, as per the company name title. But it has pop studs in each corner. And so if you press those pop studs together, you form a corner and the flat fabric becomes a very workable dice tray. I noticed that they're quite popular, a company with a lot of Kickstarters. Numenera has had them make a custom Numenera one for their Numenera 2 Kickstarter, and I can see that the guys at Janringen are doing the same, and their final stretch goal currently would be an all-rolled-up dice tray featuring some of the lovely artwork from Martin Gribb.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, go and have a look at it, guys, and back it if you're in any way tempted. Let's make it happen all the way to the end.
But let's get into that interview now,
well,
shall we?
Let's do that. But first off, I just want to say we are going to be looking here at, as I said, the history of Coriolis. But the next episode is going to be focused much more on Simbaroom, and we had a really good discussion today. It's a game that I'm really getting into and really enjoying getting into, and we had a really good discussion with Mateus and Martin about that. So the next episode, for those of you who are interested in Simbaroom, is going to be a Coriolis effect special, the Simbaroom effect. But yes, now let's get on with the interviews, Matthew, and listen and hear all about the history of Coriolis.
Today is a gloriously sunny day here in Gamla Stan in Stockholm, and even more glorious because we are sat in a nice cafe with two of the people from Järnringen, which I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that just about right.
Really good.
We have Mateus Lilja, welcome.
Thank you.
And Martin Grip. Welcome. Hello. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for finding the time to talk to us. Really excited to meet you guys. As everybody will know, we are enormous fans of the current version of Coriolis and are just beginning to understand the history and your involvement in making making the game come alive and getting it to where it is today.
We started what eventually became Coriolis.
Okay, let's ask you about that.
Yes, yes. It should be interesting to you.
Yeah. For a lot of our listeners, Coriolis is what it's all about. And one of the things about Coriolis is its non-European white cultural setting.
Yeah.
Was that there from the very beginning of Coriolis?
I don't really remember how it started. We just sort of... We had a lot of the sort of fragments floating around in the beginning, I think, with sort of cool stuff that we wanted to do. And I think just how that came about, that we had this sort of oriental or whatever you call it, that kind of thing was not... I don't know how that came about, actually. It's just...
I think it was mainly...
It was not a conscious, like, we have to do a non-sort of Eurocentric whatever. It was not that conscious. It was just...
No.
I think it was mostly... But it came we like that atmosphere.
We do. Yeah. And I think it came out of your early concepts and sketches was one. And you... And then it came out of... I started using... the analogy of the space as a desert, and indeed like space station and planets like oases in that, where you can go between the total barrenness and come into like light, warmth, where you have water and safety and all that. So that sort of became the analogy of how we imagine the game. Like, space is a really, really lonely place. So get that more better grasp of it, I think we started using the desert and oases.
Was there the concept of the dark between the stars? Came out of that.
And then we both, and several others in Järnringen as well, spent time in Spain and seen the old mix between the Moorish and the Mudéjar architecture and all that, where they mix sort of Christian and Islamic styles and almost an eclectic. Often built by Jews, so it was sort of a lot of religions and cultures just coming together in a really fairly unique aspect of that. So that's where a lot of the, I think, patterns in clothing and
architecture. Yeah, I think it started like very, very sort of not very conscious, like just finding cool visual styles. I think it started there, and then sort of, this looks kind of cool, and then we sort of just started to think around that a bit more than we started from some kind of intellectual sort of. It was more like, okay, this looks kind of cool. Can we expand?
Yeah, and I knew what I wanted the game to do, and that this style fit it perfectly because I wanted to be a sort of the clash between cultures, sometimes peaceful, sometimes not so much, and how your enemy in some cases will define you as you will you will take stuff from them. To incorporate in the way you look, speak, think, talk as you fight them. Yeah. Like the reconquest of Spain, where old knowledge, you know, Aristotle came back to Europe by way of fighting the Moors in Spain and all that. So, you know, sort of ideas and things shifting. Even if there's violence, there's also a bit of sharing.
Yeah.
So that was sort of part of how I wanted this to play out. And this became a really good sort of put some focus into how to tell that type of story, or maybe not story, but setting.
So there are other elements that I have to ask about. So when you say what you wanted, there's a horror element to it as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
So how was that there from the outset, or is that yes. something that developed just as you started?
No, yeah, we kind of wanted that space horror kind of thing. I think it was some kind of, I know, we always loved the first Alien movie, that kind of mystery yeah. combined with horror, I think was very much what yeah. we wanted to do. You know, that when they actually find that first pilot kind of thing in the yeah. first Alien movie. And that.
But it's also the Event Horizon movie, which is more Lovecraftian, where like yeah. the ship is swallowed sort of almost into a parallel with a dark place. Hell. Yeah, almost into hell, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the cosmic horror that the world doesn't give a shit about you yeah. kind of realization.
Very loneliness.
But
kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. But also the more like physical, which in Coriolis is that if you end up if you're in stasis doing a jump and there's some fault in that mechanism, you suddenly see what's between, and you don't go away. You're not the same. You get back in the sort of mental, but also sometimes like physical sense.
Yeah. yeah.
Some of that has traced over, I think, if you look closely at Simbarm, if you want to look at that, where we also have a lot of physical horror, where things yes. change you very. Obviously, if you dabble in certain things, so that's probably something that I is tickled by. But anyway, no, it started out in Coriolis. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But here it was a bit like Dark Between the Stars. You see things you're not supposed to.
You are changed by that
in a very sort of essential way. And we also gave that the small thing you could get out of it is you could become a psychic.
Yeah.
Yes.
But you're not a very powerful psychic. But you have something that others lack due to this exposure to the darkness. Mm. So that was part of it. And I don't know if it was that clearly stated early on that we knew we wanted that element in there.
I think, and also that kind of mystery element to that. Yeah, because if it was only like hard sci-fi or something, we wanted that kind of dimension of mystery. Maybe not magical, but still like a mystery to it. It's a mystical element to the world, I think. The occult kind of feel to it. I thought we were sort of attracted to it.
Yeah, and I also think that it goes back to the way we want to do stuff about people, and the reason we use a different setting is because we can put people in weird situations that can tell things. But we're not really, at least me, I'm more interested in the culture of technology than I am in technology, if that makes sense.
Yes.
And in fact, people, that was the other thing I wanted to ask. There are no alien intelligences. There are no knobbly-headed other races to interact with.
No.
I mean, there are monsters. There are things that are alien, but it's a very human-centric culture.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts behind that?
I think it's kind of... I mean, we've never been very good at... I mean, when we played role-playing games way back, we never really sort of played different kinds. So, I mean, we played ducks and hobbits.
So you always played ducks.
We've never been attracted so much to these kind of xenomorph games, I think.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And so it comes to us naturally when we sort of start making games that we don't have that much. And we're more, as Matti said, that we're more interested in people, I think, and cultures more than sort of these weird kind of.
I also think that when we play role-playing games, when we did back when, if I've had an adventure where the main bad guy is a Ilfid or like a weird creature from, I change it to a human because I want evil to be human in origin.
Yeah,
they can be allied with whatever else that makes them dangerous or weird or crazy, like in Call of Cthulhu, that's fine, but you need a cultist who has a belief or a weird idea or wants to do something, and they should in my book be human because it's more interesting to think about that rather than if you define something. This is a demon, they're by nature evil, and thus they're going to do evil now. But
you know they're going to do evil inevitably.
It's sort of like a circular argument in a sense. It's like, and I don't mind demons as long as a person called them here to do something that they wanted and things went terribly wrong.
Yeah.
That's fine because then you have a human agent in it.
And it brings up a lot of different stories, doesn't it? And, you know, the motivation might have been all positive for that, but actually it turned into something really bad.
Sure, exactly.
Your bad guy isn't actually a totally bad guy.
It doesn't have to be. It's more like people playing with powers they don't understand. They're being driven by passions and they do craziest things, and like afterwards they're like, oh, okay, maybe that wasn't the best idea.
When some village has been
wiped. Exactly. Yeah. So it's always been more like, I don't think, in a sense, you need humans are interesting, and you also don't really need more than a human as an agent. Then you can have other forces around them to make it interesting or show the consequence or you know.
Yeah.
But then again, you need the mystery, so it can't just be people and like if you have if it's only down to like physics and bad childhood experiences, that'd be kind of boring, right? You need a couple of demons in there too, right?
Yeah.
And the last element I wanted to ask about, which is one of the things I really love about Coriolis and doesn't feature enough in other games, I feel, is religion.
And the idea,
I mean, in, obviously, I've not played your version of Coriolis, but I really love the push dynamic in the Freer League version.
Yeah.
You make that prayer,
yeah.
And you get, for want of a better word, divine intervention.
Yeah.
So was that as strong? Were there religion mechanics in your version?
Yes. That was one of the pillars, basically, that we built the game on. It was based on the idea that atheism is the weird thing, not the belief.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Atheism is weird, belief is not.
That's the faith in Coriolis,
yeah,
isn't it?
Faith.
Because
yeah, so people are
to the icons being there.
Yeah. And so we wanted it to be a thing where people are religious, and also just by small tweaks, I think the Free League is doing better, but we started it, which was, I want the power gamer and the immersive gamer to do the same thing.
Mm.
You want the plus one by going to the, you go to the chapel and you pray.
Yeah.
You get the plus one. It's cool, and you're also slightly better. So the guy who counts the odds will also be there.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
That's how I wanted to, like, it shouldn't divert. You shouldn't have two, it shouldn't be either I play for immersion or I play for the rules. Like, it doesn't matter. You're going to end up doing roughly the same thing anyway.
Yeah,
So I think that's how it came about in the rules, right? You could go and pray and get a plus one.
Yeah.
And it was like, when we play tested it, and our in-house min-max guy, he just spent a lot of time in the temple. And I'm like, I know I'm onto something.
Finding a priest.
Yeah, I'm onto something now.
Usually he brings his double axe, but now he actually went praying.
And when they got their first chip, one of the first modules they bought was the chapel.
Yeah.
So you want that, right? Yeah. And then all the guys who liked the immersion, they were already arguing for a chapel because they were religious, because it said so on the paper on their character sheet.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how we tackled that.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
I love that.
William, Do you feel, let's talk about the legacy now, you know, obviously Coriolis is now, you know, Free League's game.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the legacy of the game, of what you've done, has been well handled? I mean, you said quite a few things here about how you think they've improved the game. So I get the feeling that you're sort of pleased with the way they've taken your baby.
I do like the way they tackle the games. They're very much of a... can play the game right out of the box in the sense that I think it's very sort of conducive to play with especially if you have people short on time or they're new in the genre. I think they do a lot of excellent stuff there in most, if not all, of their games. They're better than that than us. It's not, we also don't have that as a goal. We're more of a sometimes niche within a niche. But I like how they do that. I also think they, in Coriolis particular, they have expanded very consciously on some areas and scoped back on others, and I think in my book it's a better game than the one we made, rules wise particularly. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah, cool.
I've got to ask now though.
Yeah.
What was the basic mechanic of Coriolis when you were writing it? Because obviously they've taken their Year Zero engine, so they're calling it that.
The basic was you roll 2d10s, you add your skill level, you either beat your opponent's roll or a static roll.
Yeah.
And you could also, we had a system where you could get a partial success and a full success.
Mm-hmm.
How did you
manage the praying to the icons?
It usually added a bonus to whatever you were doing.
Right.
If you went to, depending what icon you choose, you got a bonus to a certain type of role. They couldn't cover anything, and you need to either have a priest or a chapel to do it. Unless you could have perks, and you could have a perk where you had sort of a truer faith yourself, and you could pray standing anywhere. You were sort of dedicated. Yeah. You were more of a mystic or maybe also a fanatic. But anyway, so you were basically doing that yourself.
Right.
And just another thing you said. We've segued into Fria Lagan's version and discussing that. Yeah. But why did you let the baby go?
A lot of different reasons, right?
Yeah, the practical reasons. We came to we ran out of steam the first Yandering iteration. Mm. People started to look at careers and families. A lot of us had kids at that around that time. So time
kids
became
detract
from the way, didn't they?
It did. No, but so people had to reevaluate their how they spent their time and it was also a difference in how people saw sort of the business side of things, whether it should stay as a hobby or with a lot of time investment, or if we should see an upside on this.
By then we did everything sort of on the side, right? So it took a lot of time because you had your main job and then you had a sort of this side job that took a lot of time, and then that became a problem.
And that point where you start having to pay tax and bookkeeping rather than just writing games.
So it was a lot like that. It was, like Martin said, it was several factors, but it came down to do we keep doing this, or do we want to make sure that we can stay as a hobby or basically go commercial. And also so it basically came to a point where we said, we're gonna stop all of this and see who wants to continue it. But we basically packed in the whole organization and by then the Fria Liga was already on board doing like licensed stuff for Coriolis for us. So we just said, you just keep going. You don't have to. We're not gonna keep going, but you should.
Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah.
Well, that was really interesting. What I was particularly interested in hearing was the way that Matthias talked about his design philosophies going into the game, about how he wanted it to be a game, not about some externalized evil alien race, but about the evil that men do to each other.
Yeah.
And that he wanted to make it about culture and the clash of cultures, rather than about strange aliens, although of course there are still strange aliens in the darkness beneath the stars. They're not alien intelligences.
They're more mystical, aren't they? Yeah. It's not like you've got the Klingons coming around the corner.
No knobbly headed aliens.
No knobbly headed aliens, which is a very good thing as far as I'm concerned. Certainly in Coriolis.
Well, it's definitely one of the things that I love about Coriolis. And what I thought was particularly interesting was how his design philosophies are still apparent in the game that we're playing a generation removed from that.
Absolutely. So we've now heard the first half of the Coriolis story. Let's see what Fria Ligan have to say about the second half.
Hi, and here we are in Samar's Hammam, but today it's not the players in the Hammam, it's the publishers in the Hammam. We've got Fria Ligan here with us in Stockholm. Thank you very much, guys, for finding the time to be with us. We've got Nils Carlian.
Hi, Nils here.
We have Costa Costulus.
Hi.
And Ricard Antroyer.
Hi.
And it's a delight. We are absolutely delighted to be here with you today, guys. So pleased that you could find the time to talk to us. We've got quite a lot of stuff we want to talk about.
Ooh, yeah.
before we kick off into that, Matt, did you have anything you wanted to...
Well, anything apart from the stuff we said we wanted to talk about?
Well, any other points of welcome?
Well,
my young Padawan.
First of all, I want to say thank you very much for the beer, which isn't normally served in the Hammam, but
it's a special case.
And also, thank you very much for the wonderful gift you've given us of
absolutely
of, Swedish editions of
Coriolis. Practicing Swedish, yeah,
and really early material as well that your wife Jenny is now charged with translating.
I'll let you know how that goes.
Yes,
we're going to see a bootleg version.
let's actually kick off. Really wanted to get an idea about where you came from, because read a little bit about you guys getting excited by the game, starting to effectively be fan publishers and then freelancers. So we'd like to hear that from your own words.
Yeah,
but also your own sort of personal
RPG
history,
how you got into it in the first place.
Yeah, should we do like a short personal history and then we can
that sounds great, in general.
Okay, shortly for me then, Nils,
for you, Nils.
I actually, my father brought home the first edition of Drakar och Demoner, which is like the Swedish Dungeons and Dragons. In 1982. It was a long time ago. I was just 5 years old by then. And we didn't understand what it was. We tried to play it, and you know, it didn't click. But like 5 years later, after my brother played a Swedish game called Mutant, me and my friends started gaming with that. We didn't really understand it either. I was like 10 years old then. But it, like, that's when like the lifelong love affair started for me. So since then, it's been like a major part of my life, and it's been Swedish games. It's been Call of Cthulhu, it's been GDW games like Traveller and 2380.
2300.
Yeah, it's one of my old favorites.
Yeah.
So a long list of games since like 1987 or something like that. So yeah. And it's never gone out of style. I mean, I never ever had a break from it.
No, likewise.
Did you not? Because I thought your introduction to the English edition of the Coriolis says it's what...
It's that guy.
It's that
guy.
Smith. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I never took a break.
Get your research right. Now. Come on. You're sat here with these guys. Get it right. Sorry.
So Costa. Yes, tell us about...
I had a break. No,
I knew that.
I started playing RPGs with my classmates in 7th grade, I think. Mm-hmm. And I also played Drakar och Demoner and Mutant. And continued playing until I was like 23 years old and went to uni. And then I started drinking beers instead and doing other stuff.
You actually role played that you were a cool kid going to clubs, right?
Yeah, we made our own RPG called Paul and Dion's, where we were cool dudes going to pubs.
How old were you when we were doing
16.
That? 16.
So...
That's a few years too old to be doing it now.
Okay.
Well, sometimes you play characters that are very like you.
Yeah.
Sometimes,
yeah,
then.
Yeah, 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 but cooler.
They're always cooler.
Yeah.
So anyway, I stopped playing in uni, and then I started lurking at the when Mutant was re-released in 2005.
Yeah, something like that.
And then when the Jan Ringen, who makes Simbrown now, released Coriolis in 2008, I sort of thought, maybe I should start playing again.
Yeah.
First I played Mutant. I actually played Mutant with Thomas without knowing him as,
right.
Well,
yeah.
Fria Ligan didn't exist at that time. And then I started, I called you guys on the internet forum.
Let's get to that because it's a fun story.
How did you meet?
Costa had to do an audition.
Yeah.
But let's do
what, to be your friend?
Yeah, no, to join our group. It was
to
like
join.
A real audition.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had to meet in a cafe,
yeah.
Yeah, with all had to carry the Coriolis rulebook so we would recognize each other.
We met on the Coriolis forum.
And I had to,
like,
to
10 years ago.
Tell them that I was a serious dude and I didn't, you know, murdering hobo only.
No. And it was like, how do you feel about minimaxing? What do you feel about... you like science fiction? Really?
Yeah.
And you mean you didn't come in at first?
No. I was,
you were like the second...
Second last.
There were other better people.
I was a bit late.
It was a prison guard that had your spot.
Yeah.
The prison guard, he just disappeared.
In real life, prison.
So when the prison...
Yeah,
in real life. So when the prison guy disappeared,
there was
he came
space.
In.
Yeah.
And that's actually the start of Free League, in a way.
Yeah, because we met at a pub, and when I started reading Coriolis, I started freelancing for Jan Ringen.
Mm.
And I wrote an adventure called The Guardians of Mahanyi, which is set on Lubao. And then I said to Nils, we should write some stuff. So we sort of sold them a PDF project to write 12 modules, short PDF modules, about the setting, more monsters.
To expand again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how we got into... That's how Fria Ligan was born.
Yeah, really.
Wow.
Yeah. But now it's
your turn. Let's hear your gaming history.
Okay. Well, I have a similar past, I think. I was the annoying little brother who joined my big brother in Drakar och Demoner. Dungeons and Dragons, the Swedish version there. And like the early edition of Mutant as well. But then I got my hands on Swedish version of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And
was that the D6 version?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Western Games. Yeah. Exactly. It was just translated effectively. And I just dove into that with everything, essentially, and started GMing it and playing it. And we played it for quite a few years, along with the Black Box of Mutant 2019.
Yeah. The Cyberpunk version.
Yeah, exactly. The Cyberpunk. That's like you wanted to do the Dread thing, you wanted to do all the cybernetics, all of that stuff. So we played that for like all through the teenage years, and it wasn't until after that I think we started exploring more our own games, things like that. I actually grew up in a city where another Swedish RPG maker kind of grew up. So
No,
in Skövde. I spent time with a guy called Kridle.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we played all of his games. Yeah. So that's like I had a long period of playing homemade games for quite a while, and then dove into Cthulhu and some other things gradually. And then I had a break when I started work. When I started actually getting real work done, I had a break from RPGs.
Because you had money to buy beers.
No, it wasn't the beer thing. I didn't do role playing myself at pubs, anything like that.
Was that the computer games industry?
No weird stuff. Yeah, I ended up there, but that's exactly.
That wasn't the job you were doing when you first came.
No, I started in advertisement, and then I did that for 6 years, and then I switched over to computer games, and then computer games tends to take up most of your time, so you don't play stuff. And then after a while, you started realizing that there was this critical mass of nerds hanging around in the computer games industry, and everyone actually were in the same situation as me. That's like, it would be fun to start playing role playing games again.
Yeah,
I like that phrase, critical mass of nerds.
yeah, exactly. So then it all kind of the past couple of years, like the past 8 or 10 years, maybe we kind of got back into it again. That was super cool. And we started sampling different games until I got a bit hooked on some free league stuff.
And we noticed Rick when his forum nick Carbonara suddenly started popping up everywhere on the free league forum a couple of years ago. It's like noticing stuff we never even thought about. So we're like, oh, this guy is
what's
either a pain in the ass or pretty good.
Decided which yet?
I'm not sure.
I think it's like, if he joins, then.
70-30.
Yeah, about a year ago, I was actually, it felt like I was kind of a pain in the ass in a sense, right? I was like, I don't like this, I'm rewriting these rules, I'm adding this, I started answering people on the forums with my thoughts.
Yeah.
and then eventually I think Thomas approached me and said, like, you know, that thing you do, would you like to get paid for doing that? So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And then I thought I was going to do a bunch of Tales from the Loop stuff, actually. But then Costa pinged me and said, you're going to write Coriolis and stuff.
Cool.
Yeah.
Enjoy.
Yeah.
So you're a relatively new member to the team, then?
Yeah, a freelance one in a quite a large crew of freelancers, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a large crew of freelancers, but I mean, Rickard is. We have like two. We have two really, really. What do you say? Profilient. You say?
Profiliate.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
As in doing lots.
Yeah.
Full
time.
Profligate.
You've all got other
edit.
No, we're not editing anything. This is just going out as it is.
But you're designing games for your day job.
Yeah.
And this is just a bit of extra pocket money out of your interest.
Yeah.
You're a doctor for your day job.
Yeah.
I'm actually working with Free League as my main job.
So you're full time.
Yeah, I'm full time.
Well, 60%.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the time you're.
That's a definition. But I mean, Rickard, along with another guy called Neil Sinsay, are like two main freelancers. Doing a lot of work. So Neil Sins is the guy who wrote Tales from the Loop.
And I was the annoying bastard who started changing rules.
Yeah.
for Tailspin.
Yeah. It does. So it's like, if it's going to be annoying, it can be annoying on our part.
Did they stay changed? Were they amendments?
I'm quite happy with the changes.
Yeah.
It went through all okay. So, yeah.
And just before we started recording, we were talking about you, Nils, agreeing with David about whether children should be dying in Chelsea. Was that one of the rule changes you made, Ricard?
No, I haven't touched that. But no. I was actually supporting the not dying part.
In
some heated debates on the forums.
I think actually I was wrong in that. So I switched my foot there because I think my initial reaction was like I didn't like it because it felt like someone is intruding on my kind of arsenal of threats for the players.
Yeah.
But like in hindsight, I think it's actually pretty great, because when you look at all the source material, like, you know, Goonies or Stranger Things or whatever, I mean, they don't die.
Kind of stuff.
They don't die. And they shouldn't. I mean, it shouldn't be a game about violence at all.
We did have a discussion earlier on about Stranger Things in the first series where Barbara does die.
Yeah, I know.
But then Matt made a good point that, well, she's probably the 15, 16, 17-year-old.
Yeah.
Not the 12-year-old.
No,
so
no.
It's kind of acceptable.
Yeah. People actually die in Tales from the Loop as well. We have in the amateurs, people, there's corpses and there's some pretty dark stuff, but
the
pieces don't die.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the difference. But so Barb can die. She wasn't the core character. I mean,
so it's okay to die if you're not important.
Exactly. I mean,
if you die for the story, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
Dying narratively creative ways.
Yeah, that's
totally fine.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, you guys are really busy. I have watched Stranger Things too.
Yeah,
I haven't.
David hasn't.
Yeah.
So
I have
don't
one.
Tell him.
No,
about
no spoilers. I'm only two or three episodes. So
one episode left.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So close.
Not talk about that.
Oh, but that last episode.
Well.
Shush.
Sorry, I've stalled. Where do we go from here?
We did have
a plan.
Well, I think for us, it's again, you've talked about it a bit already about how Free League got to sort of where you are. But I'd be really interested in, you're talking about earlier about the first iteration of Coriolis, the work that you did there. How did it go from there to the point where you are today?
Actually, Coriolis is an interesting issue, actually, because it's like the one project that's been constant since the start of Free League until today. It's the only thing that's been constant. And it's been like the backbone of Free League, and also a big problem for the Free League. It's been like a haunted project, you can say. So the problem, and actually the good thing, is we inherited this game.
Yeah.
We didn't create the setting. It was Jan Ringen, the original Jan Ringen, created this game, and we were fans of it. So, I mean, we were initially fanboys.
Freelancers.
Yeah, we were freelancers. Yeah. And they kind of ran out of steam. They couldn't really, they got tired of it. So they asked us, do you guys want to take over the game? And we took over the game. And then like a short time after that, they said, we're going to close shop. We're going to close down our company. You guys want to take over our other game as well? Do you guys want to continue? That's when we started the company.
Yeah.
So they actually phoned us. We have these two games. You can have them for free.
Yeah. What was the other game?
Svavel Winter, which is a Swedish game. Classic. It's like the Swedish equivalent of the power. What's it called? The Enemy Within for Warhammer.
Yeah.
It's like it's the most classic Swedish fantasy campaign from the 80s.
Right.
That we did a role playing game about this whole world.
Mm-hmm.
The author of that world is actually the main setting writer for Forbidden Lands as well.
Right. It's really interesting because seeing the Forbidden Lands stuff that you've been putting out through the Kickstarter, it really reminded me of old Warhammer role playing.
Yeah.
Back in
the Enemy Within.
It's funny because I think actually that's one of the. I agree in some parts, but Eric. Eric hasn't actually read Warhammer. We have written stuff as well, but he hasn't. So, but I agree that some of that. I mean, I think it's the old school feel, maybe probably.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's a really good thing.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I've got.
I love it, Warhammer. So.
Yeah, I've got a lot of really good memories of playing Warhammer in the 80s, I guess.
Yeah.
It would have been late 80s.
Yeah.
And then it just died off and we never did it again.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing Forbidden Lands coming through with a very, very similar feel for me, it's just brilliant.
I think a key thing was that we were there for the first iteration of Warhammer, which was more role-playing in itself.
Yes.
The very first edition.
Yeah.
Is role playing with a bit of miniatures, or it's miniatures role playing.
But the second was playing nice as well, wasn't it?
And then it moved into war game and a separate role-playing game. Totally. Which, again, we enjoyed. Who was running that?
Andy was, I think.
And funny enough, our mate Andy, we've sold him Forbidden Lands.
He's going to run it for us.
Because he said, I'm thinking about buying some old Warhammer that I've seen on eBay.
Yeah.
And I said,
get Forbidden Lands.
That's good. Have you seen this? And he was all for it. He's all over that. Yeah. So we've got one sale for
you. But did you play the third edition of Warhammer?
No.
We actually tried it. Yeah. We didn't like it. We bought heavily into it. We bought a lot of stuff. And we played it. And it has lots of good ideas, but it was too messy.
Right.
It was like the cards for everything. And it was like it was a messy design, but good in a way as well.
It was an expensive set.
Yeah.
So coming back to Free League, how easy did you find that transition going from fanboys, freelancers to
professional? We're two groups of freelancers. So Thomas was actually writing Svalbard separately from us.
Yeah, we didn't know that.
We didn't know
him.
Yeah. And we had met, I had played RPGs with him in a group, and we had also met in nerd pubs in a nerd project on the Mutant Forum, which I led for. When they sort of said we're going to stop doing Mutant, I started a project which never finished about Forum producing their last product which they hadn't given out.
Right.
And Thomas wrote a lot of rules for that because he had an own version of Mutant, which was actually the beginning of Mutant Year Zero in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
So we met when they said you're doing really good stuff for Coriolis. We have this other good writer who's doing Svalbard. You should merge with him and become, and you know, take over our alliance.
Yeah.
So that was Thomas.
Yeah. Thomas was the guy running for Svalbard. And then we had Christian, which is the fourth member.
Yeah.
Which was like this layout guy.
Yeah.
And he was working as well with that project.
And still is.
Still is.
Yeah. He's still in the cave.
Slaving away.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny.
Is that the bad job?
So you were a bunch of fans or freelancers initially who had a thing called Free League GAN, which had no status.
It was like a collective of creative. I mean, it wasn't a company. It was just we had to call us something.
Yeah.
What are we going to call us? It's like, Free League GAN is a faction in the game. Let's call it that.
Because GAN Ring was a faction in Mutant.
Right.
They call themselves GAN. So it's just sort of
the Iron Ring.
Yeah.
And then the logo of Free League is like, it's supposed to be, it's like a ring and it's a lily.
Yeah.
The flower lily. And it's actually after a guy called Matthias Lilja, which is a lily in Swedish, who was the main writer of Coriolis. So the logo is done after him.
Nice.
And the first adventure we wrote, which is called The Dark Flower. No, what was it called?
The dark
petals of the light flower.
Yeah.
The light flower is a lily.
Yeah,
right.
It symbols
so
death and
homage.
Very pretentious. This
is all good stuff.
None of us thought that until you said it. We thought, oh, that's really cool. Oh no, you're right, it is pretentious.
That was actually an assist idea. No, it was mine.
So then you incorporated as a company. Then with Thomas,
but actually, I don't think we answered your question. Was it hard to transition from being a fanboy to a company? Yes, it was hard. It was. We worked like 4 years totally beside our day jobs, and working nights and like weekends and just doing it like as a side project for fun. In the beginning, it was another
full time job. Kind of
it became more and more and more. In the beginning, it was. I mean, it's been super fun as well. But I mean, the bigger it got, it's also kind of a pain of running a business. When you transition from like being fun to being something that people actually pay money for
and doing the tax returns,
takes
you further away from the creative bit.
It's one of the biggest issues we've had to tackle. But I mean, every company has to deal with it.
Yeah,
but it's interesting when it like kind of merges into your, we say, creative space. For us, I think role playing games is like the most fun we know. And then suddenly it's work as well. But
So we don't play as much.
I was going to say, do you still get time to play?
That's the problem. Yeah. It's, literally all the time we have over it goes to running the company and writing games and also playtesting, of course. But it's not as much.
Not so much playtesting as we'd like.
Well, what an interesting story to listen to from the brains behind the game from its very inception right up to the current day, and with some potential, you know, snippets, you know, looks to the future a little bit as well. Absolutely, you know, brilliant to have the opportunity to sit down with all of these people and just hear that story from end to end, which is something that I hadn't really grasped before.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear, you know, as English speakers, we came in late to the Coriolis story.
We did.
And it's really interesting to hear the genesis of Coriolis.
even in that voice.
That's a good voice.
Matt's
had
a bit of a cough
voice
this whole trip, so that's the problem.
Yeah, it's my husky, sexy voice.
We might edit that bit out.
We've got we will not edit my husky, sexy voice out. Loads more stuff, though, and
we
so
have.
Over the next few episodes, there's going to be all sorts of stuff. First of all, Dave, we think we might do a Simba Room special next
time.
Yeah,
as I said earlier, we're going to do a Simba Room special, which will focus on Simba Room and the parts of the interview we had with Mateus and Martin that focused on that game and where that came from and where that might be going. So that'll be next. Hopefully in the next week or so, we'll get that out with a bit of luck. But beyond that, we will. The next few episodes will focus on the content of the interviews. But what we will try and do is pull out the key things, and then Matthew and I will, having pondered on what it all really means, we'll offer our own further comment and suggestions, and maybe even spin off some ideas that we can throw into, talents of the week or other thoughts on setting or rules.
Yeah. We're really looking forward to this. So it's so much inspiration from hearing these guys talk.
Yeah.
And I feel a little bit smug that we've only given you a tiny bit of it in this episode. And there's plenty more to come over the next 3 or 4 episodes, I imagine.
Yes, there's loads more. And again, one final thank you to all the guys for sparing the time and being so generous with their time and generous, with hosting us. It's been a delight.
And I'm looking out of the windows now and seeing the sun setting over Stockholm and the lights coming on. And I think, Dave, we should take one last walk through the old town of Gamlestan up to the station and get the train to our flight home.
I think we should as well.
And so we'll be saying goodbye to you from both Dave and I.
And may the icons bless our flight home.
You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.